New guidelines for every American to follow over the next 15 days.
Stay at home. That is the order tonight.
Stay home.
We can flatten the curve.
We had 15 days to slow the spread, we were told.
100% of the workforce must stay home.
Now, I was already skeptical of government command and control, but I was still surprised at how authoritarian many politicians were eager to be. Those 15 days turned into years, and the loss of our freedoms increased.
This is not about freedom or personal choice.
It should have been. Instead, everywhere, politicians kill jobs, pass laws that make everything cost more.
Costs are going up everywhere, from the grocery store to the gas station.
They sped up America's path toward bankruptcy.
The largest stimulus bill in U.S. history, $2 trillion.
Politicians and unions closed schools and caused a historic setback for young people.
Scores decreased by the largest amount ever recorded.
And the deep state's rules probably killed people. COVID tests were available for use.
Hundreds of these machines are currently in the United States.
But
they're not allowed to be to test for the virus.
Not for coronavirus
because
yet.
You need FDA approval.
Yep.
4 years later, let's remember politicians' incompetence and their insatiable wish to gain power over us. Let's not give them power like that again. Nor should we trust the hysterical media. They're always eager to make life scarier than it is.
There is a very good chance there's no room for you in the hospital right now if you need to go.
And the worst is yet to come.
What follows is one of my first videos from the beginning of COVID. Sadly, it was just a taste of what was to come.
Some governors are still refusing to take action to protect their own citizens.
The media keep insisting government must set stricter rules.
10 states have no stay-at-home orders.
Even some on Fox say it.
It is necessary to shut things down everywhere. And that includes Utah, Wyoming.
Wait a second. Has he ever been to Wyoming? It's got so much open space. Why would the same rules apply here as in New York? It's creepy how some people are so eager to have authorities boss us around. Police departments now monitor people with drones.
This is the Volusia Sheriff's Office. Please adhere to social distancing guidelines.
Now some people are saying enough. These people are protesting North Carolina's stay-at-home order.
I feel that my rights have been completely removed.
On Twitter, the police declared protesting is a non-essential activity, and they arrested this woman. But wait a second, the Bill of Rights does say the American people have a right to peaceably assemble and petition the government.
All public and private gatherings of any size are prohibited.
Michigan's governor probably imposed the harshest rules.
Residents can no longer visit friends or relatives. Those who have more than one home banned from traveling between them.
No wonder people staged this protest against her rules.
They say it goes too far, takes away their rights, and in some cases is too arbitrary.
Arbitrary is how it looks. Big stores may stay open, but they must not sell certain things.
Big box stores will also have to close areas of the store that are dedicated to things like carpet or flooring, furniture, garden centers, plant nurseries, or paint.
But things like gardening and painting are activities that can be done far from other people. So is exercise. But watch out in California.
A paddleboarder is chased down by law enforcement for being out on the water at Malibu Beach.
This man was more than 6 feet from anyone, but police chased him down.
He cut him off!
And they punished him.
Yep, this paddleboarder was arrested.
In Encinitas, California, police gave $1,000 tickets to people watching the sunset. Yes, they were inside cars, not endangering anyone. That day, the police posted this video saying, "We go to work for you."
We're going to continue to be doing enforcement. We're dealing with the crisis at this point, and we want compliance from everybody because this is lives that we're trying to save.
But it's not clear that demanding total compliance is the best way to save lives.
In the Swedish city of Malmo, life appears to be carrying on almost as normal.
Sweden took a near opposite approach. Yes, they encourage older people to stay inside and tell sick people to stay home. They don't want hospitals overwhelmed. But otherwise, they let life happen.
In this street in Stockholm, there's not much evidence of social distancing.
Sweden's leaders don't think an extended shutdown is sustainable.
Closing schools, more stringent measures like that, closing borders,
You cannot do that for months or years ahead. What we're doing in Sweden, we can continue to do for a long time. And I think that's going to prove to be very, very important in the long run.
Because of vaccines, probably more than a year away. Until then, the best protection is what epidemiologists call herd immunity, a critical mass of people who get the disease and then are resistant to it.
Herd immunity is the one thing that will eventually slow down the spread of this virus. Nothing else will slow it down in the long term.
The idea is that once enough people have gotten coronavirus, there'll be enough immunity to prevent future mass outbreaks and to protect the most vulnerable people.
That idea was widely mocked by the media and experts from around the world.
Sweden's failed experiment. How their dangerous COVID gamble went wrong.
Officials made the decision not to lock down, hoping it would lead to widespread immunity. But cases are surging.
Excuse me, MSNBC. Now we know Sweden saw the lowest excess death rate in Europe. So I figure I was right then to say what Sweden did
seems smarter than the absolute shutdown promoted by many American authorities.
If we see continued noncompliance, they'll wind up facing misdemeanor charge, and DWP will step in and shut off their water and power.
Shut off their water? Let's be sensible about this. Politicians are supposed to serve us, not just boss us around.
We'll keep pushing back against government overreach. If you want to help us, please click that. Activists have a new goal, degrowth. They say it might save the planet, because if growth continues,
it means a future of climate chaos.
The no-growth idea is popular. More than 1,000 so-called experts signed this letter,
calling for an end to a capitalist system which pursues growth at all costs.
Our addiction to economic growth is killing us.
Growth is not killing us, it is saving us.
Author Johan Norberg points out that growth is essential to human progress, especially for poor people.
Growth is most important for people who have the least. In poor countries, if you open up your economy, if you manage to grow by 4% annually over 20 years, that reduces poverty in that country on average by 80%.
But the activists claim,
our addiction to making and consuming more stuff is exhausting the planet.
Degrowth is better, they say, because it puts well-being ahead of profit. They say we should buy less stuff, grow our own food.
A smaller, slower economy could also be a sweeter economy.
A sweeter economy? This degrowth argument is just nonsense.
We've just had an experiment with degrowth, unintentionally, during the pandemic.
Suspending all travel from Europe.
States urging people to stay home.
Half the world's population was under house arrest. All the flights were grounded. Did that save us? No, it was a terrible tragedy for humanity. 60 million people were thrown into extreme poverty in that 1 year alone.
Yet some activists say the pandemic was a good thing. It gave the planet a break.
The global shutdown did a lot of environmental good.
Shutting things down did reduce carbon emissions, but
by no more than 6%. So if we wanted to reduce global warming, then we would need one pandemic like that every year. And that would be a terrible disaster for human life and health.
Yet that is what the degrowth movement wants. They say growth means climate change is worse and we take up more space and we destroy nature.
If we didn't have any economic growth since the 1950s, we'd have slightly less global warming, but many more people, around 500,000 more people, would die because of climate-related natural disasters. In fact, the risk of dying has declined by some 90% since the 1950s. And that's not because we have fewer disasters or because there is no global warming. It's because we've had economic growth. And it means that we improve construction, we improve early warning systems, we improve healthcare, which means that we can deal with all these problems and all disasters in a better way than we would otherwise have had.
In addition to limiting harm from disasters, growth gives us more choices.
Growth is not really about money. It's about opportunity. It's about the chance of doing the things that we want to do with our lives.
Like pursuing work you enjoy and having more free time for leisure, friends, and family. over time, even a little growth makes a huge beneficial difference.
If Sweden, my own country, had had just 1 percentage point lower economic growth per capita, then Sweden today would be as poor as Albania.
What's wrong with Albania?
Albanians are a quarter as rich as Swedes, and that shows in everything from life expectancy and child mortality to working conditions.
Albania's growth was limited by years of communism. As a result, today, these Albanians risk their lives to try to get to countries that grew richer.
Albanians now make up the single largest group arriving in small boats.
That's what you need to know about different economic and political systems. Look at where the refugees go. They always go from more socialist economies to capitalist economies. People risk their lives to get to freedom and to prosperity.
We urgently need to shift to a post-growth, post-capitalist economy.
A post-capitalist economy. Degrowth activists say the real enemy is capitalism. This professor says capitalism is at war against life itself.
We?
This degrowth advocate wins applause, saying,
urgently dismantle capitalism.
What then would be better? We invited him and more than a dozen other degrowth promoters to join us here to explain the evils of capitalism and how degrowth will be better. Not one would agree. This activist emailed that he'll pass because Stossel TV is nowhere near his standard of rigorous journalism. It's too bad that not one of them would come here to argue. I wanted to hear the capitalism haters explain what's wrong with free markets. Because Norberg's new book says the global free market will save the world? That's pretty grandiose.
But it is saving the world. Bit by bit, step by step, every day. Every day over the past 20 years, more than 130,000 people were lifted out of extreme poverty. Every day!
That means growth lifted millions from stoop labor, from burning manure from heat, from lives where they die young. And when people get richer, then they can afford to care about protecting nature. That's why rich countries have cleaner air, even water you can swim in. Only growth will give us the technology to reduce pollution and adjust to climate change. Degrowth would leave the world poor, miserable, and polluted. Since growth is good, I'm glad our YouTube channel's growing. If you want to help us get to 1 million subscribers, please subscribe and hit the notification bell to make sure you get our next video.
We choose to assert ourselves as a global leader in transitioning to 100% renewable energy.
Scaled up across the country right now.
Renewable power is so much better, we're told. Instead of increasing pollution, we get carbon-free power from the sun and the wind.
And I might add, windmills do not cause cancer.
A new documentary series, Juice, Power, Politics, and the Grid, notes that politicians have pushed renewable energy for a long time.
Jimmy Carter put solar panels on the roof of the White House. It's quite intuitive for people to understand that there's a lot of power in solar energy. We feel the wind. And the idea that you can get something for nothing, people find that enormously appealing.
This is our moment, a comprehensive clean energy bill for our country.
Leaders in California are aiming to generate 50% of their electricity from renewables by 2030.
California might now achieve that, but to get there, they're forcing people to pay much more.
The cost of electricity in California has increased 3 times faster than the rest of the U.S.
People in Washington now pay an average 11 cents per kilowatt hour. In Oregon, they pay 13 cents. In California, though, almost 30 cents. Do they at least get reliable energy for that? No. There's a problem with wind turbines and solar power.
They don't work when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining.
Blackouts happened over the weekend with little notice.
California learned that renewable power isn't reliable.
2 million people now plunged into darkness across California.
Even the governor admitted.
we failed to predict and plan.
A few years later, California only avoided another blackout by pressuring people to cut their power use.
Keep doing what you've done. One or two more nights of this, and we will turn the page.
Will they? So far, their biggest impact is to make things cost more.
California will require all new homes to have solar power.
It's the reason California has the most expensive housing in America. The average house now costs almost $800,000. If you can afford that, you get government money for generating solar power. But the handout mostly goes to rich people, and it's inefficient.
As their solar panels produce power during the day when the sun is up, they're able to sell the excess power that they produce into the grid exactly when the grid doesn't need it. The grid is then inundated with solar power and can't use it all. Nonetheless, they get paid a very high price for that power. And then when the grid actually does need the power and they aren't producing solar and nobody is producing solar, then they get to buy their power back at a reduced rate.
Nice for homeowners, but of course, poor people who pay rent.
Those people are paying for the rich people to have a highly subsidized solar system.
I put solar panels on my house, partly because of a tax credit. But I won't delude myself into thinking that solar or wind power are especially green. Solar panels and wind turbines impose environmental costs too.
Just to produce one turbine, we have to extract 900 tons of steel, 2,500 tons of concrete, and 45 tons of non-renewable plastic. Then we've got to transport that and burn fuel, getting it all carried across the world and put up. And none of these things that go into a turbine are renewable. They're going to eventually wear out.
Now most shut down in just 10 years to do maintenance that gives the energy company another tax credit. The maintenance costs almost as much as a new turbine. But it's worth it to companies because the renewable movement's driven mostly by government handouts.
The Biden administration announced today an $11 billion subsidy to bring clean energy into rural communities.
Of course, free government money puts wind and solar in inappropriate places.
Even with our snowy, dark winters, Minnesota ranks 11th in the country for solar power.
Because taxpayers fund it.
The state's about to give me a whole bunch of subsidies to build wind and solar in Minnesota. To build solar in Minnesota. Scenic, sunny Minnesota.
How well do solar panels work in snow?
Not well. The Juice series highlights the stupidity of subsidizing energy that just feels green. It won't measurably affect climate change. When solar and wind become more efficient, then they'll be cheaper and people will adopt them on our own. Politicians should just stop their destructive meddling.
We will eliminate in the state of California the sales of internal combustion engines.
You can watch the full documentary at juicetheseries.com. If you want to help us keep the lights on, click that button. Have you noticed how some in the media just suck up to some politicians?
I'm struck just in your presence.
Struck in her presence.
Looking you in the eye with your passion that you are displaying.
Republicans are treated differently.
If I may finish just answering.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and interrupt you here.
On the DOJ and the FBI.
Just on my question, though, Governor.
Excuse me.
Aggressive interviews are easy to notice, but some bias is more subtle. For example,
what a great campaign.
The media have always covered Iowa caucus victory speeches.
We're going to want to listen in very, very closely.
Thank you, Iowa.
But this year, when Trump won.
Thank you. We love you all.
CNN cut away from his speech.
Here he is right now under my voice. You hear him repeating his anti-immigrant rhetoric.
Actually, no, Jake. You hear him. We don't. CNN wouldn't let us actually listen to Trump and decide for ourselves. MSNBC showed none of Trump's speech. Rachel Maddow said,
we will let you know if there's any news made.
Maddow says it's not responsible to broadcast Trump live because he lies so much. But we reporters can point that out. instead of cutting away when he talks. I've repeatedly reported on Trump's lies. Trump lies even about unimportant things like the crowd at his inauguration, the ratings of his TV show. But Biden lies too. Here he lies about doing well in law school.
Ended up in the top half of my class.
Biden now concedes he did not graduate in the top half of his law school class.
He also lied when he said,
I have never discussed with my son or my brother or anyone else anything having to do with their businesses, period.
I shouldn't be surprised that the media treat Republicans differently. For every Republican in newsrooms, there are 10 Democrats. And now NPR has actually hired this woman to be its new CEO. She not only tweeted, Trump's a racist, but during BLM looting said, sure, looting is counterproductive, but it's fine because what they're looting comes from a system of oppression. She's now the boss of government-funded radio? Yes. Here's another example.
The governor of Texas refuses to give in to federal law.
Recently, reporters suddenly got very upset about rule of law.
The governor of Texas refuses to give in to federal law.
The media can't believe that Texas politicians put up a fence and won't remove it, even after the feds told them to. But when it comes to sanctuary cities, the tone is very different.
Communities that shield undocumented immigrants by not reporting offenses to immigration enforcement.
They choose not to follow federal immigration laws.
They simply choose not to follow the law. They don't refuse like Texas does.
The governor of Texas refuses to give in to federal law.
Finally, the way the media labels politicians is just biased. Argentina's new president is a libertarian who promises to take a chainsaw to big government. So the media call him far right.
Far right radical.
Far right Javier Milei.
Far right Javier Milei.
Far right libertarian Javier Milei.
At least she calls him libertarian, but libertarians aren't far right. Most of us support ending wars, free trade, gay marriage, and all sorts of things far from far right.
Milei supports legalizing the sale of human organs.
Maybe you oppose organ markets, but it's not far right. Conservatives are more likely to oppose organ sales. The shallow media just label anyone who doesn't agree with them right wing.
Argentina elected a right-wing former TV host.
Far right.
Far right. And Trump-like.
Donald Trump of Argentina.
He makes Trump almost look like a conventional political candidate.
He is nothing like Trump.
Economist Daniel DiMartino points out that Milei's policies are very different from Trump's.
The only thing that's similar to Trump is that he went against the establishment. He's funny in his speeches. He's charismatic. He has crazy hair. But that's it. I mean, this is a guy who's for free trade. This is a guy with very set on principles, who's very smart on economics.
The media eagerly cover protesters who oppose Milei's cutting the size of government.
Thousands are attending at demonstrations opposing his drastic cuts to public spending.
Media call most any budget cut drastic, slash and burn, astronomical, draconian. But at least in Argentina, the proposed cuts are big. A lot of people don't like this. Unions are protesting.
In Argentina, it's very popular to protest and block streets.
It's the second protest against him this month.
But President Milei did something different because some union members get welfare payments.
He said that anybody who blocks a street illegally will lose all welfare benefits. Guess what happened? No streets were blocked.
Who knew that protesters blocking streets could be stopped by threatening their government handouts? You won't hear it from the leftist media. Libertarians get trashed. Republicans get interrupted and their speeches cut off. But Democrats largely get a pass, even if you can't tell what they say.
Beer brewed here, it is used to make the brew beer in this final. Oh, Earth Rider, thanks for the Great Lakes.
But there is some good news. Today, more people ignore leftist media. CNN's primetime viewership fell behind the History Channel's recently. More people now get their news from independent journalists who publish in places like Substack and YouTube. Like us. It's a good trend because we're more thoughtful than the silly people on TV.
Mr. President, what did you order?
Chocolate chip.
Oh, yeah.
Our independent journalism isn't cheap, so if you want to help, click that button. Argentina has elected an unusual president, a man who shouts, "Liberty." Javier Milei recently became the world's first libertarian president. He campaigned with a chainsaw, saying he'd cut the size and power of government. Milei is the unusual politician who won election talking about freedom.
¡Viva la libertad, carajo!
Now he's in charge of the third largest economy in Latin America.
An economy with big problems like horrible inflation. People save their whole lives only to find their savings wiped out.
People in Argentina are struggling with one of the highest inflation rates in the world.
It happened because these Argentine rulers awarded huge subsidies to unions and special interest groups, thereby running big deficits.
Tengo que decírselos de nuevo. No hay plata.
The previous government dealt with that by just printing more.
Policies to counteract this deficit, like printing money, only make things worse.
Milei understands that governments can't create wealth.
El Estado la destruye. El Estado no puede dar nada porque no produce nada.
Libertarian attempts to shrink government haven't gone far in the United States. But in Argentina, Milei won big, won by 3 million votes. The media then said he can't pass his reforms.
He's not going to be able to do any of those things. He has no experience and he does not have an economic team. So he's going to fail.
But he hasn't failed yet.
He was able to repeal rent control, price control.
Daniel DiMartino, who escaped Venezuela to become an economist in America, points out that Milei has already done a lot.
Now he's pursuing labor reform. He eliminated all restrictions on exports and imports, all with one sign of a pen in one day.
He can just do that without Congress?
The president of Argentina has a lot more power than the president of the United States.
Ministerio de Turismo y Deporte, afuera!
Milei campaigned promising to eliminate entire government agencies.
Ministerio de Ambiente y Desarrollo Sostenible, afuera! Ministerio de las Mujeres y Género y Diversidad, afuera!
Department for Women, Gender and Diversity, out.
That department reminds me of a very famous government agency in Venezuela, which is the Vice Ministry for Supreme Social Happiness. They're just government agencies to hire their cronies and keep them voting for them and appearing in protests.
Cutting government spending is a risky thing for a politician to do. People get ticked off when you end subsidies. There have been riots in countries where they cut those subsidies.
What's incredible about Milei is that he was able to win on the promise of cutting subsidies.
Se acabó la joda. Se acabaron los privilegios de la política. Se acabó.
Almost no American politician ever wins promising to cut spending.
But Argentinians are fed up with the status quo.
Once one of the richest countries in the world, there are many reasons behind Argentina's decline.
100 years ago, Argentina was one of the richest countries in the world.
When you become rich, and then you think money grows on trees, then you forget why you became rich. And then you gradually lose it democratically with handouts, an ever-growing state, one intervention leads to another, until we are in a situation like the one we have today.
Milei wants to help Argentinians escape massive inflation by making the dollar Argentina's currency. He campaigned holding this dollar bill with his face on it.
Part of a widely criticized campaign to use the U.S. dollar.
Widely criticized by people who think you can alleviate inflation with price controls. Prices were controlled by the government.
Of everything, eggs, meat, gasoline, and now they're not.
Argentina's socialist government had tried to control most everything.
The regulations in Argentina were such that everything that was not explicitly legal was illegal. And the mentality is now changed with Milei's decree, all by executive order, that is basically everything that's not illegal is legal.
One regulation loosened the rules on Argentinian airlines.
And now even airfares are cheaper than bus fares.
He scrapped the laws that said, buy in Argentina.
Yeah,
America has some of those.
And it only makes poor people poor.
Why?
Because it increases cost. Why shouldn't Argentinians be able to buy Brazilian pencils? Why shouldn't they be able to buy Chilean grapes?
Because we want to support Argentina.
Well, guess what? Not every country is able to produce everything at the lowest cost. Imagine if we had to produce bananas in America.
Malay has also been selling government-run industries.
State airline, the state passenger railway, the military railways. There are really hundreds of companies that he is going to privatize.
Argentina stocks are soaring.
Stocks rose sharply when Malay was elected.
The decisive victory of Javier Milei.
Yo filosóficamente soy anarcocapitalista.
Anarcho-capitalism is the idea that all government should be abolished. Private companies would provide even the police, the courts, the military. So far, Milei has not proposed that.
Most of us libertarians don't go
that far. Libertarians don't support anarcho-capitalism. They support a small, limited government.
Rosa es Milton por Milton Friedman.
Ay, Milton. Mira, Milton.
Milei is an economist. One who even named his dogs after other libertarian economists. One is named Murray after anarcho-capitalist Murray Rothbard. Robert and Lucas get their names from Robert Lucas, who won a Nobel Prize for increasing understanding of inflation.
Most people don't even know who these guys are.
The fact that he's naming his dogs after these famous economists show that he's really a nerd. And I think it's a good thing to have an economics nerd president of a country.
Especially one corrupted by big government.
We have never seen something like this happen democratically in Latin America, ever.
What can Americans learn from Argentina?
We need to keep America prosperous such that we never are in the spot of Argentina in the first place. And that requires free markets.
Yes, free markets work. Hope his reforms get a chance to succeed. I'll keep reporting on Malay's Argentinian revolution. If you want to help, please click that button. Did you know that through the apps on your phone, government spies on us? You should worry about that, says privacy advocate Naomi Brockwell.
When you downloaded this app, you gave the app permission to access your camera.
In this previous video, Brockwell told me, I've foolishly given up my privacy to tech companies and the government.
You've probably given location permission, you've given microphone permission.
In that short video, I didn't have time to include some of her good points.
Let me have a look at your phone. I want to see what apps you have on your phone.
What she saw made her say,
if I were you, I would delete almost all of these apps. First of all, because
I like them.
I know you like them, but you're taking your phone around with you everywhere you go. It's an intensely personal device that sees where you're going. It sees every person that's in the room with you, every person you've connected with. It has a microphone, a
camera. What should I delete?
Right off the bat, Google Chrome. This is a terrible app for privacy. Google Chrome is notorious for just collecting every single thing that they can about you. Chrome is a browser, which means it's kind of like your gateway to the internet.
Yeah, I like that.
Well, you like having a gateway to the internet, but do you like all of that information being collected and then broadcast to thousands of different companies? Because Google is not really a search engine, the same way that we used to think of it as like Google, we can search the web. It's an advertising company. So Chrome is collecting every single thing that it can about you, and it is broadcasting that to thousands of people to see like who wants to bid on the opportunity to, you know, be in front of this man here. Google is auctioning off your eyeballs, essentially, to advertisers. But it's not just advertisers who are collecting this information. There are thousands of shell companies, of shady companies, of data brokers who are also collecting it and in turn selling it. So the run-on effect from using something like Chrome is huge because it means that so many people then get access to your data. I'll delete it. You don't need it. Something like Brave works way better.
Brave is a browser that's just as good and doesn't collect this information.
I would say it's better because it doesn't collect this information.
And it works a little bit faster because it doesn't deal with all the ads and the record keeping.
Exactly. Every time you load a web page, there's that split second before everything gets loaded because there are these little empty boxes all over the screen and Google's busy auctioning off those eyeballs to all of these people who want to fill the boxes. So there's lag time. There's bandwidth that gets taken up through this process. And with Brave, you can block all of this. It's fantastic.
What else?
We're sensing a pattern here, but Google Maps. I would delete Google Maps.
But I need Google Maps.
So you don't. You actually have an iPhone here and you have Apple Maps on there. So Apple and Google both collect a lot of data, but
Apple sometimes one is better than the other. I like having both.
Well, Apple is way better when it comes to privacy. Google is tracking everything.
But what's better at finding where I'm trying to go?
Well, Apple is actually, I say, on par with Google now. It didn't used to be. It used to be kind of bad. But in the last couple of years, it
has... So just have fewer of these.
Have fewer of them. But Apple actually goes out of its way to try to anonymize your data. It doesn't store in its databases your exact locations. It uses this technique called fuzzing.
Good. What else?
Oh, gosh. You've got Gmail on here. That's another one. They're all Google.
But I use Gmail.
So I would stop using Gmail.
What should I use instead?
There are lots of more private email alternatives out there. ProtonMail is a great one. TutorNota is a great one. There are many others. The difference between them is that every email going into your inbox for Gmail is being analyzed. It's being scanned. It's being added to a profile about you. Google has a terrible track record.
As soon as you connect to the internet, Android uploads to Google a complete history of where you've been that day.
I've made videos about that and asked,
is Google doing creepy things to us?
The answer is yes, Google's former boss says.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Brockwell and others say Google does cross the creepy line, but nothing beats Google's convenience. It remembers my credit cards and my passwords. It fills things in automatically, so I don't go through torture like this.
Incorrect password.
Is it a
ways to protect yourself from not losing passwords, and that's a whole other area we could discuss. But I do understand the trade-off between that. If you put your data outside the control of a company, you have to take responsibility for that data, and that is a trade-off. But I say it's absolutely worth it. Email is so personal. Email is private correspondence about everything in your life. And I think that we should be taking those private communications out of the reach of the companies that want to read them and use the companies that put that data outside of their own reach, that don't read our emails, that have actually made it technologically impossible for them to read our emails. And I think that using those services is also a vote for privacy, to tell the market, give a market signal that we think privacy is important. That's the only way we're going to get more privacy and for it to become easy.
The list of apps she says I should delete didn't stop at Google. There are many more.
Why do you need an app for Shell? Why do you need it? Why do you need this? You would go buy gas at a station. You need an app to somehow facilitate.
Yeah, I don't have to get out of the car. I press a button. It's all ready. It's easy.
So you do have to get out of the car because your fuel tank is accessible from the outside.
Right,
so what
okay.
are you gaining from using this app?
Somehow it's faster and easier.
No, it's not, John. Just put in a card. We think that we need an app for every single interaction we do with a business, and we don't realize what we're giving up as a result. All we're being told are the upsides, the conveniences of this. And most people are oblivious to the fact that they're really undermining their privacy.
Yes. Brockwell showed me what my Shell app tracks on my phone. This long list is publicly visible on the App Store. I never bother to look at any of this stuff, but do they really need...
Your purchase history, your contact information, your physical address, your email address, your name, your phone number, your product interaction, purchase history, search history, user ID, product interaction, crash data, performance data, precise location, course location, user... I mean, the scrolling goes on. They're collecting so much information. The first step before downloading an app... Take a look at their permissions.
Google and Shell. Any others there?
I would delete everything here. I don't think that you need an app for half of these things. You've got apps here. I'm not going to tell people what apps you've got on your
sure,
device.
Tell them. I don't care.
No, you should care. I'm here to tell you why you should care about this stuff. You've got a New York City COVID app. Why do you need a New York City COVID app right now?
Because maybe there'll be a time again I have to prove I'm vaccinated to go to some store.
Great. And if that happens, think about downloading it. But before you do, look at the privacy implications of doing so.
All right, you can delete that.
I can delete an app? All right. Okay, remove app, delete. Oh, doesn't that feel good? It's like you have one less tracking device on your phone that you're carrying around with you. Doesn't that feel great?
And the phone feels lighter already.
It feels lighter. The burden feels lighter. You feel like you have more freedom, less surveillance. This is a good feeling. I encourage you, if I'm going to give you homework, I encourage you, just go through and see, like, what's an app that you haven't used in the last month? 3 months, 6 months. And you know what? Just delete it. And if you need it again, you can always re-add it, but with the awareness that doing so does degrade your privacy and put your data into more hands.
Another way to limit data from getting into more hands is to change the apps we use to communicate.
Some of my friends now want to text via WhatsApp because it says it's encrypted.
WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted and is going to be better than standard SMS. It's nowhere near as private as an app like Signal, which is an open source app that is really secure and is highly regarded by most security experts.
So it's secure or it's not secure?
WhatsApp collects a lot of data about you. It shares it with its parent company, Facebook. And that data includes, you know, who you are, what time you're calling people, who you're calling, intersection of data.
It says end-to-end encrypted.
The content of your messages is end-to-end encrypted. Take a look at your default backups of your devices and whether that's just being saved in some cloud. There was a scandal where that was going on for a long time and people thought they had private communications, but actually everything was just immediately available.
So even when I think something's encrypted and private, it probably isn't.
There was a document that came out that was leaked by Rolling Stone a couple of years ago that showed all the different private messaging apps and how they compared in terms of privacy. And Signal app was the best. WhatsApp was one of the worst.
They already have all my data. What's the point of going private now?
You can think of it like when you date someone, right? So they know everything about you and you're fine with that. But the moment that you end that relationship, would you still be comfortable with them knowing everything about you going forward? No, you'd probably stop them having access to your Amazon account and your Netflix account and access to your email. You probably wouldn't want them to have that information going forward. Privacy comes down to choice, right? It's not that I want everything that I do to remain private. I'm a public personality as well. I show videos of myself doing all kinds of crazy things. I let people in the public watch them. It's that I deserve to have the right to selectively reveal to the world what I want them to see. And currently, that's not the world.
Thank you, Naomi Brockwell.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for watching. If you missed our earlier video about how governments get their hands on this data and why that's a problem, click here.